What makes or breaks a family? That families are breaking up everywhere in our American society is clearly apparent, and it has become gravely alarming. 10 million living Americans have been divorced. 378,000 couples were divorced last year. 3 marriage licenses issued, 1 divorce suit is filed. America's rate of divorce is the highest in the Western world, and it is rising. There are 6 million children in the United States who do not live with both parents. Now, why are so many homes breaking up? Many valid explanations have been given. The family today, it is maintained, is a much smaller social unit, much more mobile and urbanized, and it is no longer supported or buttressed by the extended family group which prevailed in rural America or in small towns, and which still prevails in many European countries. A speaker at the recent National Conference on Social Welfare thus contrasted the family of present-day America with that of yesterday. We all know, he declared, what that rural family was. But let us look at it again. It was a family that tended to stay put. It was usually composed of several generations, as contrasted with the nuclear family of today, husband, wife, children, and perhaps a mother-in-law. It was the kinship or extended family that enjoyed the support, companionship, and cultural continuity of grandparents and great-grandparents, of aunts and uncles and cousins. It was a life of interdependence. People knew each other and aided one another. It was a small town where there were no strangers. It was a church with a pervading and powerful moral force on its constant congregation. It was a family in which each member had a recognized essential job, where the roles of wife and husband and child were well-defined and vitally important. It was a family which spent almost all of its time together, found its own mutually shared recreation, carried on much of its own education, transmitted its own cultural values, and was largely dependent upon itself for the production of food and clothing. The elders were the homegrown marital counselors. This family provided its own babysitters, homemakers, and foster homes. When one of its members married, the new couple rarely left to fend for themselves. They simply became junior members of a well-established firm. Advice and supervision were always available, given freely. The family's social status was clear. To achieve and maintain respect, it simply had to support itself in decency, provide the essentials of life, be God-fearing. Its moral codes were clear and unrelenting and enforced by all the community. It was not essentially the perfect family. But whatever its psychic difficulties, it was so constructed that it did not easily become disorganized, and it was seldom subject to complete breakdown. That was the family of yesterday. And what of today's family? Today's family is a very different family. The couple married out of romantic love. Their marriage was not arranged, as it once would have been, by their parents. This couple see their own parents perhaps once a year, and the rest of the relatives, for the most part, exist only as an annual Christmas card. They expect to move at least two or three times while their children are growing up, not infrequently to other states, and even across the country. Family friends must be newly made, perhaps every two or three years. The family must establish its own status. Few know and fewer care what the grandfather had achieved or who the great-grandfather had been. No generation established reputation follows the family. The traditional roles of husband and wife are no longer distinct, and each family must find its own balance. The wife no longer has a clear-cut role. The demand for industrial workers has taken millions of mothers into industry. At the same time, a role as mother and housewife has been devalued. It is of low status. Often from her employment, she may earn as much or more as her husband. The mores of the community, the patterns of sexual conduct, its standards and values are not so clear or so socially enforced as they once were. In essence, the family is alone, isolated, separated from relatives or those to whom it would be natural to turn for counsel. It must in large part make its own choices, vote its own decisions, establish its own values. Thus the family today is in a real sense subjected to greater strains and tensions and to increasing responsibilities. And greater stress is accordingly laid today on personal relations, on husband, wife, children. Within a sort of a nomadic civilization, 15 million people in the United States move every year. And in the midst of an urbanized civilization, this family has become, as the author said, rather isolated and almost entirely self-dependent. And within the last generation or so, two world wars contributed to the disorganization of family life in our country. By the uprooting and the transplanting of millions of men from their normal environments, from their customary ways of life and standards and disciplines, transplanted to camps or overseas. Divorces always rise sharply after a war. War and broken homes are closely related as cause and effect. The emancipation of woman, however desirable that was, and her growing economic independence as a result of the increasing employment of women in industry, undoubtedly has contributed to the divorce problem. The incidence of divorce is higher among working wives than among housewives. And 7 million mothers in the United States are employed in industry. 2.5 million of them with children under 6 years of age. All this has tended to accentuate the problem. Poverty, slums, prolonged unemployment, and all their attendant miseries are also factors in this problem. Divorce is more frequent among the poor than among members of the middle class or the rich. Although it should not be overlooked that divorces rise during good times and decline during a depression. Divorces are by no means, as we all know, limited to the poor. And economic security is by no means always synonymous with family security. But without a reasonable measure of economic security, the resultant strains and stresses endanger the stability of the home and the family. There are, of course, instances of fundamental maladjustments between man and woman, between husband and wife, sort of incurable maladjustments. And such people are, of course, better off divorced. And no amount of conciliation by courts or counseling by social agencies or the skill of the psychiatrist will help in such a situation. There's clearly not been established any basic union to keep that marriage, that home, stable. And Judaism accordingly countenanced divorce, though it deprecated it. But men and women do not always know whether their seeming maladjustments are really fundamental, or whether they're only sharp differences and bitter misunderstandings which may be resolved, given time and forbearance and the help of a wise counselor or a family agency. Every opportunity should therefore be given. Opportunities for reconciliation should be available in every community. And cooling off periods should be made mandatory before suits for divorce are filed. Divorces are most frequent in the early years of marriage, before the cement, so to speak, of married life has had a chance to unite the young people firmly and closely into an enduring life companionship. And so, my dear friends, many explanations can be given for the rising rate in broken homes. But of course, an explanation is not a solution. These explanations seem simply point up the fact that it is more difficult today to preserve a sound family life than in the past. The greater demands must therefore be made, greater demands upon the character and the will of those who would build a family and those who would preserve it. The solution is not in having new divorce laws, though a sharp reform in American divorce laws is long overdue. The solution, in my humble judgment, is not a new solution by any means. And the great solutions of the moral life of man are never really new. The solution lies in a full recognition on the part of the men and the women who enter marriage and who want to build a home, who want to preserve it, a full recognition on their part of the new and the heavier responsibilities which are involved in family life today. And a challenge to these men and women to face up to these greater responsibilities. It is basically a matter of attitudes and dedications which the individual man or woman must personally and voluntarily assume. It's not a matter of for courts or agencies or the psychiatrist. When marriage reaches these outer agencies, it is already on the rocks. It may be salvaged, of course, through these instrumentalities. But marriage should never be permitted to reach that deplorable stage. We seem to forget in this day that not everyone who sues for divorce is a neurotic in need of psychiatric treatment. Sick marriages are not always or even frequently the result of sick minds. They may be the result of immature minds, of lazy wills, an unwillingness to face the burdens of partnership and the necessary adjustments of a new relationship. An immoral person is not necessarily a sick person. We seem to have forgotten this fact. Faithlessness and adultery and gambling and excessive drinking and quarreling over money and selfishness and rudeness, which so often lead to the breaking up of a home, these are not diseases which can be clinically treated. These belong to the laboratory or the surgery inside the individual's own soul. He himself must make the diagnosis, and he himself must prescribe the remedy. The individual must operate on himself. And that's the whole genius of the moral mandate that is given to man. Behold, I have set before you this day life and the good and death and the evil. Choose ye life. The challenge in all moral situations, and particularly in this great moral situation, is directed towards the individual and towards the capacities within his own life, his soul, his mind, to control, to direct, to master a given situation. There is no successful marriage or home or family without a tremendous effort. In some instances, the effort is less apparent than in others, but it's always there. We all bring to our married life not only our initial love and devotion and our dreams, but we also bring all of our imperfections. Even though our first romantic love would tend to obscure this simple truth. Every human being is a compound of endless contradictions. Every human being. Of sharp angularities. Of things rough and unpolished. Just as in a real sense, every human being has physical imperfections of a greater or lesser degree. And we learn to live with them, for we must learn to live with them. And the great effort which men and women must make, and that is the supreme wisdom of life, is to grow into a compassion which will disregard these imperfections in each other, and which will help us to share the strength which is ours, to heal each other's weakness. And everybody is inclined to do that, to make that effort. It is an effort, sometimes a very great effort, to be a trifle blind to each other's defects, to make allowances for our common frailties. It takes a great effort to understand each other, and in patience and forbearance to learn to give to each other what each other needs. And that is the secret of a happy life. To learn to give to one another what each one needs. We must make the effort, and I stress the word effort, but without effort, conscious, no home, no family is permanently secure. We must make the effort not only to overcome our initial disappointments at not finding that perfection which we were looking for in our mate, which really does not exist anywhere in the world. But we must also make the initial effort to overcome the troubles and the cares and the adversities in our economic fortunes. Life is a strange journey, and you never know how you will fare. And those who really want to build a home and preserve family life will have to learn how to be drawn closer together by the ties of ill fortune and financial worries and similar disappointments. For in the long run, dear friends, it is better to carry a load on our shoulders than to carry a load on our hearts. The love which builds a home and a family is not exclusively a compound of sweetness and light. It is often distilled out of pain and grief and tears and loss. It is often a light which breaks through a deep darkness. There are strange discords in its basic harmony. Love is not love, said Shakespeare. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds. Men and women are sometimes inclined to run away from their problems and to seek a solution for them in separation. The solution is to be found in closer attraction, in closer companionship, and in shared burdens. A family is strong, dear friends, when its members all try to cooperate and never seek to dominate. Who is the boss in this family? That's a fatal question to ask. It should never be asked. A sound family is one where each is free to express himself fully as an individual human being without endangering the family unity. For each member of the family, husband and wife and child, assumes full responsibility, where none abdicates. The father doesn't say, I can't do anything about it. Mother says the same thing, and the child proceeds to exploit them both. A sound home is where we treat each other, adult and junior, where we treat each other as we would a welcome guest who has come to our fireside, that we welcome him in a holiday mood, that we are hosts to those whom we love. A sound home is one where no one feels neglected or alone or unappreciated or taken for granted. And many a home is wrecked upon this feeling of abandonment, of not being necessary. Now, such a home is sound and weatherproof. It looks on tempests and is never shaken. Now, it is not beyond the capacity of any normal human being to build such a home, but it requires the effort, the conscious effort. Frequently, the greatest sins we commit against one another are the sins of thoughtlessness, the unpremeditated acts of thoughtlessness. The building of a home is an enterprise which calls for the best and the strongest and the wisest in us. I am not ignoring all these grave outer factors to which I referred at the beginning. They are there, and perhaps some solutions can be found for them. I doubt it. I am speaking now of what the individual man or woman, young and old, can do to build a home. A normal individual man, woman. I'm not talking of sick people who need the doctor's care. And for such a home and family, it is well worth making the supreme effort. It never fails of reward, and the harvest is always rich. We won't get always what we are after, not everything we set out to do will succeed. It is not in the nature of things. Frequently we get more than we are entitled to. Often we get less than we think we are entitled to. But this sincere effort to build a home and a family will save us from many drab days and from many empty years. This kind of a home, rich or poor, sumptuous or very simple, this kind of a home will shelter infancy and childhood with boundless love. It will guide youth with firm and loving hands. It will inspire young manhood and young womanhood with high standards and noble ideals by the magic and the enchantment of example, of what they see before them every day and every hour of the day, of the mood and the temper of the world of the home in which they live and have their being. That's where young people derive their ideals and their aspirations. And it will fill our mature years with stimulating companionship, with a sense of worth and confidence and dignity. And after a long and eventful voyage, it will enable us to reach a calm haven of golden memories and a long serenity. And what else do we want in life? But without effort, all this is not possible. The mere act of marriage, the hour or the year of infatuation, is not an automatic guarantee of a lifetime of home and family. It is the beginning, it should be the beginning, of a continuous and continuing fine effort on the part of man and woman and of the child in the family to do everything to make the home a place where people want to be, to which they like to come back, around which sentiments and love and loyalties develop, and which later in life becomes the model for other homes which children build elsewhere. Now, all that I have told you is ancient wisdom, the wisdom of our fathers. And it is because of this wisdom that our people was able, through the centuries, cruel centuries of adversity and of wandering and of being uprooted and of being subjected to all kinds of degradations by the world around them, it is because of this inner wisdom that our people were able to build a home life and a family life which have become, were up till recently at least, the envy and the admiration of the world. We Jews ought to do our utmost to recapture this the sanctity, which is not beyond the reach of any human being who seeks it. This quiet, noble sanctity place which shelters the soul and nourishes the spirit of every human being.